Voice of the Cape Drive Time, welcome back to the show. 072-238-0712 is the WhatsApp line. Feel free to query, comment, stroke, and or criticize. At Voice of the Cape and on Drive Time, we do a lot of book reviews, and of course we support our local distributors, people such as Timbuktu Books in Sabran Park and Ikara Publishers in Pretoria. And Ikara in Pretoria sent me a very interesting book the other day entitled Manufacturing Terrorism in South Africa, The Securitization of South African Muslims by Muhammad Nadim Hendricks, who is at the Faculty of Education, University of the Western Cape. Guess what? In Cape Town, South Africa. I'm going to quickly read something on the jacket, and then we're going to get into the meat of this very interesting work. This book uses securitization theory to explore how Muslims have been constructed as a security issue in Africa after the 9/11 attacks in the United States. These attacks became the rationale for the United States' Global War on Terror. GWAT is its acronym, and I really love it. The centrality of Africa as an arena to execute the GWAT, the Global War on Terror, is the focus of this book. It focuses on how Western-centered security discourses around Muslims permeated the South African security discourse in our post-apartheid period. And of course, the popular press and the local think tank community have some critical thinking to do on this account. But Dr. Muhammad Nadim Hendricks, assalamu alaikum and welcome to Drive Time.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Now, having a look at your very interesting work, the securitization of South African Muslims, what inspired you originally to do such intensive research on this particular topic?
When I started, it was about the Muslims became equated with terrorism, and I wanted to understand what is the origin, who is propagating it, because it's through the continuous propagation that we come to what we believe is the almost like the factual knowledge. And I just wanted to have an insight into that question.
And of course, during your book, when one reads it, one realizes that a lot of things that were assumed to be fact in this whole terror discourse were in fact just speculation. And you start off very interesting with the White Widow, Samantha Luthwaite, the Kenyan Westgate Mall attack, and you unstitch it and you come to some interesting conclusions. So what happens in the first chapter in terms of Samantha Luthwaite? That's an interesting story, isn't it? Because it was a story based on an assumption, based on another assumption, and then another one.
Yes. I think that chapter, for me, summarized the entire book. If you've read that chapter, you've read the entire book, and the rest of the book will give you the more detailed insight into the conversation. But what happened in... there was an assumption that when the Kenyan attack happened, that a British woman is behind it, and this woman became Muslim, and that it then became obvious that it must obviously be her. But at no point could they show that they've that she was involved. Then experts were created. A person that is situated at the university with no experience in the study of terrorism was identified by the media as an expert, and he then acted as if he was the expert, and that became the truth. So you have a system of generating or creating knowledge which would not have a foundation if you really start to scratch the surface.
Yeah, I mean, I think one could go on to say that it's blatantly dishonest.
Yes, but the way, and that's the interesting thing, the way the system works It's precisely like that. A number of the terrorism stories that I've would have a political aim, but there's no factual basis. I just want to give you an interesting example. There was a time where a group of 35 Germans were abducted in Algeria, and the Americans followed them deep into Malawi, Niger. But that problem never existed. It was the Americans creating that story because they wanted to establish a base in Africa. And so they wanted to show to the Africans that you don't have the capacity to deal with terrorism. So they've created a story to justify the establishment of the of this particular base.
I mean, that's interesting because I can remember chatting to a State Department official. I'm not going to mention his name because he'd had a couple of whiskeys when he was talking to me. And he forgot I was a journalist. And he told me in his drawl, Shafiq, you know, and this was when they were trying to implement AFRICOM. I said, you know, we got to have AFRICOM, but we can't have boots on the ground.
Yes.
And ironically, at that same gathering, some Kenyan delegates came to me. This was at a conference, and they were begging South Africans not to go down the United States GWAT rabbit hole, Global War on Terror rabbit hole. So what you're saying is very interesting in all of the context which we're discussing.
Yes. You see that is the example that I've used was basically to establish American command, AFRICOM, in South Africa. Now, what's also interesting about that event, there were two African leaders that opposed that the African Union should give permission to AFRICOM, and the two was Thabo Mbeki and Muammar Gaddafi. And we both know how they were displaced. So the interesting question, did the ANC remove Mbeki, or was this just a different way of removing Mbeki because he acted as a stumbling block? We know how Gaddafi was removed, but I think it would be an interesting question around how Mbeki was removed.
That's a good question. In fact, ironically, this is not about me, but I was in Libya in 2011, and Gaddafi was taken out by foreign agents, not by Libyans, because if Gaddafi had hung around, he would have burnt just about every single European leader for their hypocrisy. So your thesis on Mbeki, I think, certainly has a huge amount of resonance. We just carry on.
I just thought I just wanted to show how complex this conversation is. So it's not just about terrorism in Africa. There are a number of factors that motivates these activities, and maybe just to bring it more to my study. Two entities in society are drivers behind that, and that is research institutes.
Ah, yes.
Which is called in the think tanks, and the other one is the media. They form what I call in this book epistemic or knowledge networks to propagate specific kinds of knowledge for. And it becomes extremely difficult for anyone else to argue against this. And I think this book tried to show where these thoughts originate and who are the actors. You will note that a number of the think tanks would have the history in the Cold War and apartheid security. So the same people that were security experts in that period this continued throughout post-apartheid period, and today we still draw on those people as our experts to tell us how to pursue our security.
You know, I'm glad you're mentioning this, because this is one of the reasons why I really wanted to do the interview, because in the media we are sometimes bound to these think tanks. And you've got the South African Institute for International Affairs, you've got the Institute for Security Studies, you've got SIPS and the Brandhurst Foundation, who are extremely shadowy. If I were to ask him to come on air, we would struggle. And I've always wondered why. Then I read your book. Yes. Then I realized. I'm sure you'll agree that each one of these so-called think tanks or NGOs, as you have done, when you analyze their sources of funding, it becomes really clear what their agendas are.
Now, if we look at a person, say the Institute of Security Studies, the person that started that is Jackie Salier. And Jackie Salier comes out of, and he first met with the ANC during the apartheid period. It was one of those initial meetings with the Mkhonto we see to the military wing of the ANC. Immediately when he came back, he started the Institute for Security Studies. It had a different name at that time. And so I'm convinced that that was actually a creation of the State Security Council of Bhutan that sanctioned the establishment of the Institute for Security Studies. Then it is actually Jackie Salier that brought the idea to South Africa that there's a link between the Afghanistani Mujahideen and terrorism in Africa. And he then linked that to some of the activities that happened in Cape Town. He became quiet on that after introducing that debate. But his institute continued to pursue that argument consistently. So these things are fairly linked. Also, if we look at the Institute for Security Studies, they have offices in places like South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria, and God, up to the other name, but it's the same places that, or the countries that the American strategy to influence significantly the African states are the same places. So we need to ask the question, is it by accident that the Institute for Security Studies would have the same areas as important areas to pursue their research? And it's for me obvious that it can't be just by accident. Perhaps they act as a proxy to propagate specific kinds of knowledge.
Indeed, and this has affected us as the community quite detrimentally. What about the Brandhurst Foundation, which seems to have two faces? It will, in one arena, it will hint that Muslims are not good, and then up front say, no, there are some good Muslims, sort of Mahmoud Mamdani's bad Muslim, good Muslim scenario.
I think that the Brandhurst Foundation, in particular the director, he follows the same position as I've argued initially. But I think the Brandhurst Institute has a different agenda, and probably more linked to the Western intelligence. But if we look at their key motivation is to promote capitalism in Africa, particularly to promote American economic interests in Africa. So you will see, if you read any article by their director, you will see all of it will speak about why China should not be around. So, and that is almost like I can, when I read an article and I see this person is the author, I already look for what are they saying. So initially, they've argued for why the African command should be established in Africa. And two reasons stood out. The one is to prevent terrorism in Africa. And secondly, to almost like discipline China in terms of its access to Africa. And that is the almost like the two spheres on which in which they operate.
And of course, what is deeply insulting to us as a community is that some of these think tanks seem to operate on the underlying assumption that Islam is a faith of terror, that it is going to ultimately indulge in terror. And if you look at SIPS, I think they attached the University of Pretoria and a certain professor that used to run that institute. It becomes quite sad because this particular individual was saying things about the community. He was from the community, saying things about the community based on our own media reports and saying that those were facts. It was quite bizarre sometimes.
Yes. Now, it's interesting, him in particular, because when I spoke to him and I interviewed him, he told me, don't look at what I write in my articles or experts like me are saying. What he was suggesting, he was doing it because he's working for a specific organization. So he himself might not believe in what he's propagating. But that brings me to another part of what I've tried to show in this book, is that people from the Muslim community, there's an attempt to recruit leadership and opinion makers from the Muslim community to be co-opted into this bigger plan. And a number of people are actually involved in this process and they're not aware of it. And this strategy came directly from the RAND Corporation. That's an American think tank that directs American policy on terrorism. There's a long story about the RAND, but for the purpose of this conversation.
So many things to discuss, but we can't end the interview without having a look at South African media's representation of Islam and Muslims. Something in the media at Voice of the Cape in particular, we were still in the eye of this particular storm, where the media picked up on what we're discussing in terms of the think tanks and perpetuated the myth.
Yes, in fact, frequently there's almost like a symbiotic relationship between the media and think tanks, because the media draw on them, and when they are being almost like cited on in the media, it elevates their standing. So there is this this almost like this direct relationship, and but it's also specific individuals in the media that propagates these ideas. I was just reading this morning an article on events in Mozambique, and the assumption that ISIS is now invading and taking charge of some province in Mozambique. And the same authors are actively, like I'm talking about the media, are also involved in the propagation of those ideas. Where is it coming from? That is, who's propagating those ideas? On what basis are they able to make these pronouncements? They haven't done any research on the matter. Now, that is some of the complications of people just writing and propagating ideas without facts.
No, absolutely. Unfortunately, Muhammad Nadim Hendricks, we have to leave it there. We've been talking about a very interesting publication, Islam and Global Studies, Manufacturing Terrorism in Africa, the Securitization of South African Muslims. Thanks to ICRA Publishers for sending me this book. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan, so this is definitely in the mainstream. Dr. Muhammad Nadim Hendricks, it's been a pleasure chatting. I know we only scratched the tip of a huge iceberg, but well done on this very influential work.
Thank you very much. Drive Time.